Welcome, folks, to the Goose Gossip Podcast. I'm your host, Levi Gerke. Thank you for tuning in. I have on a lot of great guests that come onto the show. Also have an Instagram and Facebook. Just look up the Goose Gossip Podcast. Helps you stay updated with new guest speakers as well as some great content. This podcast is brought to you by the following. Molt Gear. For 16 years, Molt Gear has been bringing the hunt hard, hunt alive philosophy with their lineup of calls, instructional material, and apparel. Each call is tuned by the owner of three-time World Live Goose Calling Champion Scott Trinan, based in the heart of Goose Country, Rochester, Minnesota. Check them out at www.moltgear.com. Dakota Decoy Company, established in 2007. Dakota Decoy Company has built and grown the company to offer a full lineup of top-quality decoys, blinds, and accessories that you, the demanding hunter, not only expects, but deserves. Located in Vermilion, South Dakota, along the Missouri River. Or check them out on www.dakotadecoy.com. Premium gunning decoys for demanding hunters. Mallard Bay is an Airbnb-style marketplace for discovering and booking guided hunting and fishing adventures. The Mallard Bay platform was built by sportsmen for sportsmen, and their mission is to help expand access to affordable and successful hunting by connecting you with verified outfitters across the U.S. You can browse trips and prices by state or species, select the dates you'd like to go, message outfitters, and make your deposit with a credit card. Fastest and easiest way to book a guided trip with a verified outfitter, go to www.mallardbay.com. Other Guys Outfitters, home to one of the biggest concentrations of waterfowl in the United States. Great people, great hunting. Reach out to them on their Instagram and message them to book your hunt now, or you will not want to miss out on their hunts next year. Bourbon Media prides themselves in being the leader in all things digital marketing for the outdoors industry. Websites, social media management, paid advertising, SEO, logo and design, and content creations. Focus more on your business and let the professionals at Bourbon Media increase your company's digital profits. Contact them on Instagram or Facebook at Bourbon Media, or reach out to them on their website at bourbon-media.com. Webfoot Waterfowl Co., the most comfortable and trustworthy lanyards you can buy. Many options available from color to size. Head over to their website, www.webfootwaterfowl.com. As well, you can find them on Instagram. Go check out their product. I have several of their lanyards. Love every single one I have. K2 Coolers, established in 2011, with a commitment to design a quality cooler that would give years of reliable service at very affordable prices. Located in Broussard, Louisiana, check them out at www.k2-coolers. When you think of K2 Coolers, think real value, real cold. Big thank you out to all my listeners for enjoying this podcast as much as I do. It is great hearing from all the great feedback from all my listeners. Sit back and enjoy this episode. Welcome back, folks, to another episode of the Goose Gossip Podcast. And the special guest on the phone today is Scott Trinan. Scott, how does it go, my man?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. How's the weather in Minnesota? I mean, it's been a little wet here in South Dakota. Is it kind of the same in Minnesota?
It's been a really, kind of, I would call it miserable spring. you know, we haven't gotten any of the snow. We usually get like a early mid-March, late March, you know, 10-inch dumping of that wet, heavy heart attack snow. But we didn't get any of that, but we also haven't gotten any sun, haven't dried out, just windy, cloudy, cold, rainy, a few snowflakes in the sky. It seems like every day. So it's been kind of a miserable spring, and especially if you're a little bit of a turkey hunter, there hasn't been very many real good days where they, you know, just let it loose. It's kind of just stuck in a stagnant pattern, but looking at the 10-day forecast, I guess that's supposed to change after today. So it's all looking up.
Really? Yeah. Cause I mean, it's been just brutally windy the entire, like, 3 weeks or the past 3 weeks here in South Dakota. And I am,
yes,
you know, it's one of the greatest sayings of, it wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't for the wind here in South Dakota. But, let's put it into factor. It's pretty annoying when it's 30 miles per hour wind at a minimum every day that you wake up, and I have to work outdoors, and it's just not fun dealing with that. But
yeah. Yeah. I got a lot of, trees on my property on the lawn and stuff, and it's been a very dirty winter and spring for those as far as dropping sticks and limbs, and yeah, it's just been blowing a dog off a chain, it seems like, for 4 months now. So it's adventures of living in the north.
Exactly. You got to love it, but you got to hate it at the same time. At least
that's right.
At least we didn't get any tornadoes like Kansas. I mean, bless the people's soul over there. They had a tornado touchdown over there in Andover, Kansas, I think. And
okay.
Yeah. I guess
we don't need any of that.
No, we don't. And I think we can deal with the brutal cold and the brutal wind here and there. It's just one of those factors.
That's right.
How's the shop running for Molt Gear this year? On the off season, starting off on the off season.
You know, it's good. We purchased this property in August 1st of 2020, and it had two Morton buildings on it, about 200 yards from the house. And it was one of the attractions of purchasing the property is because we could put a shop out here. And so from August 1st, or we closed, I think, August 30th or something like that, or maybe it was August 1st, until June 2nd of 2021, we worked to finish off the shop because it was just a steel frame building and stuff. So we put in the in-floor heat and the concrete and the walls and the rooms and, you know, the sheetrock, the painting, all that. And we moved
the whole
in
nine
last
yards, huh?
Oh, man, I tell you what, I'm not much of a carpenter at all. I'll be the first to admit that. And I figured, you know, I had a bad idea. It was like, you know what, if I'm going to be working in here, I'm going to put some time into this carpentry work and learn how to do it and do most of it myself, and that was just a bad idea. You know, I learned a lot, but it just took it takes a lot of time,
it does.
And a lot of time. So we moved in last June 2nd, I believe it was our first day working in here, and the shop was, I would say, like 50% complete. The call room where we build the calls and stuff, that was done enough to, you know, start working in here, and then finishing off the other room, which is kind of a, I guess you would call it, a hangout or a lodge type of room and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We worked on that and then kind of finished that up last fall. And I would say right now it's like 90 to 95% done. Basically the last 5 to 10% is just kind of decorating, photos, little touches here and there, but otherwise, all the other stuff is done and it's been great. You know, it's easy walk to work every morning and get to look out the back in the field and the woods and see wildlife, and
that's amazing.
Yeah, we love it out here, so it's busy and we enjoy it. So
was this
a place to work every day?
Was this the first transition for the shop itself for Molt Gear and yourself, or has there been a separate transition since you started Molt Gear?
No, so we used to live in town in Rochester, and we had a small shop out in the back, and it was probably way too small for what we were doing, but we made it work for, we started making calls in 2012, Molt Gear for the first, 6 years was DVDs and CDs. So most of that was ran out of just my basement of my house, shipping that way, and, you know, didn't take up a lot of room except for storage of the media and stuff like that was out in the garage, and I'd go out and get it and ship it out and stuff. And then once we started making calls, we built a little addition off the back of the garage and stuff. It was probably only 600 square feet, maybe. Something like that. Yeah, very small. And, you know, here's the thing about calls. You know, they're an inch and a half wide by 4.5 inches long. You know, you can fit a lot of them into a small space.
Exactly.
It's just when you start growing and, you start adding machines and engravers and drills and lays and blah blah blah, the whole nine yards, you know, you just need more room and whatnot. So, and we were looking to get out of town anyways, and it was kind of a, I guess I would call it, a 3 or 4 year kind of struggle. I was kind of in the, well, probably is still in the boom of the housing market, but, you know, we'd find a property, go put an offer on it, and there'd be six others, and we'd get beat stuff like that. So this one was kind of a blessing in disguise. I was actually driving up to Pine Island, which is the neighboring town to Rochester, about, 7 miles north of Rochester. They do some of my machining work up there on our calls. And I was driving up, and I just by chance happened, I'm like, I'm going to go the back way today, you know, because there's kind of a river road that goes up to Pine Island. And I was just cruising, you know, it was a nice summer day. And I drove by this place and it had a for sale sign in the front yard. And I was like, wait a minute, I haven't seen that on, you know, the real estate apps and stuff like that.
Correct.
I was like, what's that one? So I turned around and, you know, it's on a dead end gravel road. So I, you know, turned off down the road and I started driving by it slowly. I'm like, okay, the house is really good. And, you know, looked and seen the sheds, which was obviously an attraction to me, with my work and kind of what I wanted to do with the property. And, you know, ended up calling my sister, who was our realtor, that day. That was at probably 10 o'clock in the morning when I drove by.
Okay.
We had a showing at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We put an offer in at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and it got accepted at 7 o'clock in the afternoon. And then we closed 28 days later. So it was kind of a weird deal, you know, and it's, lucky. And, you know, it's located about 3 miles outside of Rochester. So, you know, going into town, you know, hunting, you know, it's close by, but it's still out in the country and stuff. So it worked out, really well. We got lucky on that. So
now is this, the shop that you have now, is that kind of like open to the public or is this just like your shop, you know, where things are designed and made?
It's both.
Okay.
You know, we don't have like set hours here or showroom, you know, or anything like that, but people will call up and they'll be like, hey, I wondered if I could swing by today, blah, blah, blah. And sure, come on by. But we don't have like a, you know, 9-to-5 showroom where you can, you know, if people want to stop in, they're more than likely, but it's a workshop. It's where we, you know, when we get the calls, they get CNC turned, by a machine shop. And then when we get them, we do all the polishing, the engraving, the painting, the tuning, and the shipping out here. So, you know, but the room that you walk into first is kind of it's more of a display of Rochester history and goose hunting and stuff like that. And then the back room is, you know, where we build the calls.
Just a nice gesture of the reason why you started it all, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you bet. And a place to hang out, you know, sometimes in Rochester, you know, these geese are a little stubborn. They're not going to get up and get after it too hard. So we'll meet out here, have coffee or after the hunt, vice versa. And yeah, it's good. So
over the evolution of Molt Gear itself from beginning to now, there's obviously a history that you could sit here and talk for hours about. But I mean, the evolution of it, what's your outtake on it personally? Was it just a blessing in disguise or has it been a strive to success?
As far as Molt Gear?
Yeah, Molt Gear itself, I feel like, you know, you've branded the name very well, and the person that you are behind it is just an amazing factor. So the outtake of it is like, I mean, there's glory in everything, but there's also bad in everything. So what's your greatest outtake on, you know, yourself starting, you know, a call company that has been a successful company in all realms?
Well, you know, back when Molt Gear started in 2006, we came out with Bad Grammar, the CD. And that was kind of just a spinoff of what I enjoyed, which was being around geese. I was in contest calling back then, and my kind of niche, I guess you would say, and some of my success with contest calling was new sounds, new notes, new sequences. And those weren't anything that I created. You know, those were all just stuff that I learned from the geese, you know, being around geese.
Correct.
And literally I had, I think it was 30 or 31 tapes, which were 60 minutes long. See, back then when you videoed something, it was on a little small cassette tape, you know, whatnot. And so I just basically went out and filmed geese, got the footage and the audio, a lot of it, probably more so audio than footage. Some of it was footage, but, you know, just putting the camera down and letting geese do what they do and whatnot. And I just had this, you know, just this, well, 30 hours of audio. And I thought, man, I mean, you know, a lot of the stuff that's out there today, which was back then, obviously in 2006, as far as instructional material on calling, none of it really dealt with the live goose. You know, it was kind of the stuff that I watched and, you know, scene and stuff like that. It was more just a guy talking, and this is how you do the note. It was no real audio or sequencing of live geese and stuff. So, you know, honestly, I went to Best Buy. I bought a $9.99 mic that I plugged into my computer, and I downloaded like a free version of a track maker, which, you know, you just, whatever it is, you know, you just make the track and then cut it. Yeah. And I had my buddy duplicate it, the first CD at his work, you know, just laid these things in there and recorded and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, when someone asks how much, you know, I had into Molten Ear to start it, well, the fact is $135 to get my state tax ID number and my name, Molten Ear, and then basically about $15 into production of, you know, whatnot. I had the camera from a long time ago. It was a crappy old camera that I used. So, you know, it was a really in the basement startup. And then it just kind of took off from there. You know, guys really liked the CD and maybe the personality that was on there. It was kind of enjoyable to listen to maybe, and different, and had the live bird on there, which, you know, is something that you can't argue with when it comes to sounds and sequences and stuff like that they do. So then in 2008, we decided to make the DVD, which was a little bit more of a production, you know, filming and, you know, editing, you know, and stuff like that. And that went over extremely well. And then we came out with the Goose Society and Goose Society 2 and Duck Society and Goose Society 3. And then in, you know, 2012, it was just kind of a natural progression, I guess you would say, is to start making calls. You know, I never really envisioned it or, you know, had a goal to make them, you know, when I started Molten Ear, but it just, one thing led to another and it seemed fitting. And I think basically I kind of had the realization that this is what I want to do, you know, and this is the next step to make that happen, you know. And when I come to work every day now, I love it, you know. I mean before we had kids and stuff, in 2015 we had our first child, boy, but you know, even a little bit after that, I mean, I would, you know, work 6-7 days a week all year round, and I never complain about it. You know, it's, I don't know. I enjoy coming to work, and to get that enjoyment, it seems like calls were just kind of the next thing in it. So, and, I think to go back to your question a little bit, as far as, you know, the
outtake of it.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's just, I guess it's just a goose hunter that loves goose hunting that is bringing people geese and goose sounds, you know, and everything that we've done, whether it be our calling teachings or our calling techniques or our hunting, it's all been based around the goose, you know. You know, they'll give you all the answers, you know, and you just got to spend time around them. And I think that's maybe why it's translated so well to hunters, is because they know it's coming from the goose, you know, and not just, you know, some guy's opinion most of the time. So I think that's the bottom line, is that, you know, we've always kept it about the bird, the sounds and their movements and their tendencies, and not about us so much, you know. And that even goes back to the name, you know, it's not named after me or anything like that. It's just more about, you know, the bird than us, I would say.
Yeah. And the greatest outtake that I took from Molten Ear itself and yourself is that your voice is such a welcoming voice inside the Bad Grammar. Because I've watched, when I first started goose calling, it was, I mean, you could have went on YouTube and typed in how to goose call, and there was a red line full on YouTube throughout the whole basis. And I never generated like a complete like connection with the people that are trying to teach it. And I'm not just saying this because you're on here and this and that and the other, but
sure.
The part of where you were explaining how you went out and put in all the effort of recording live geese, and that it's about the live geese, and that's how you train yourself to be with, you know, trying to call like a goose, you know, try to commit that goose is to call like a goose. And, you know, your voice, and then You're the corresponding of like how you taught on bad grammar was so welcoming and so easy to learn off of that it was a basis that it was enjoyable at that point because you got to hear yourself, then the live goose, then hear you. And it was just, it was a well thought out plan. And hearing the basis of it, now it makes a lot more sense on how much work went into it. So it's really cool to hear that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. You know, and I think that, you know, it might come with a little enthusiasm for what you're talking about. You know, I've never, I guess, you know, personally, when I look at it, I guess I've never shied away to talk about, you know, calling or hunting or techniques or strategies. It's honestly, it's what I love the most, you know, is obviously hunting the goose. You know, I'm a hunter before I'm a call maker. You know, that's the bottom line. And if people, like to talk about that, I think that's what I get probably the most excited about in this whole deal. So there probably is a little bit of enthusiasm that comes across, and maybe that's part of the welcoming aspect.
Do you as a hunter still get to get out, you know, after starting a business and running a business? Does the factor of still being a hunter, does that still come in factor for yourself? Like, can you just push the business to the side when it comes to Minnesota opener, or how does that lay out for yourself throughout the season?
You know, that's a great question, and that's something we get, you know, emailed, or if somebody leaves a voicemail, it usually goes, I'm sure you're out hunting. I'm sure you're out hunting, but the reality is no, that has definitely went the other way.
Right.
When I grew up in a small farm town just west of Rochester, 10 miles. And I would, after the chores were done, I grew up on a dairy farm, and after the chores were done, I would grab my decoys and run out on the fence line when I was 12, 13 years old. And then, made a good connection when I was 14 in Rochester and started guiding. And I hunted pretty much, I mean, every day, you know, especially when I got out of high school and, was guiding and stuff like that. And then when decided to start molt gear, you know, I still hunted quite a bit when I just had the DVDs and CDs, cause they weren't time consuming. You don't have to make those, you know,
right.
You just have to put them in a package and ship them after the production is done. But when calls started, they take some time. You know, we hand polish and hand paint and do all that stuff. So they take a lot of time. And then as molt gear grew, my days out in the field have significantly dropped, and add on a family to that, you know, those responsibilities with two young kids now and stuff like that. So when I tell people, I usually hunt about 20 to 25 days a year. Wow. That seems like the perfect balance as far as keeping up in the shop, keeping up, you know, with the family, keeping up with other responsibilities, keeping up with the property, and then, you know, still getting out there enough days to keep up with, you know, what's kind of going on in the geese. And I would say that, you know, just for hunting, for, you know, waterfowl hunting for 30 years, I've kind of got Rochester a little, I guess you would say, not figured out by no means, but you know the ins and outs of what's going to happen and when it's going to happen.
Right.
And I always tell people, I've missed a lot of average days waterfowl hunting, goose hunting in Rochester in particular, but I've hardly ever missed a great day. So, you know, I'll see it coming on the weather app and know it's going to happen, or, you know, what's happening to the north of us and stuff like that. And then I'll plan around it, where if it's just a one day hunt, or if we're going to go at it for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, you know, I don't miss those days. You know, I'm out there,
right.
But I might miss a lot of average days, but I won't miss any of the good ones.
So do you haven't acquired the state or the status of like hiring employees so that you can go do your fun when you want to, or is that employees are at the shop doing, you know?
No, we got Ryan and Mike that come in. So we got two guys, and they take care of all the polishing, the engraving and the painting. And then I do all the tuning on every call that goes out, and, kind of the packaging, as far as shipping. So I'm a, When it comes to that, I just think that is the that's the personal touch of Molt Gear, is that I don't think that can be the final tuning is, you know, you can design a great call and make it look wonderful and polish it perfectly and paint it awesome and, you know, have it look like a showpiece. Well, if it doesn't sound like it should, then the call is no good, you know. So that final aspect of that tuning is, I think, something that I just don't think I could hire that out. You know, that's our kind of our stamp on that. So I take a lot of pride in that. I enjoy doing that, is probably more so than anything as far as the pride aspect goes, but I really do enjoy it. So I'm just around for that. I don't see that ever, you know, being hired out, even to sacrifice, you know, some days out of the shop. I think that's an important aspect of it. And sometimes it might happen from 4 o'clock till midnight to make up for the day I went hunting. Or a lot of times I'm a pretty early riser, so I'll come out early and, you know, I might start tuning calls at 3:30, 4:30 in the morning, and then, you know, go hunting after that and whatnot. So, over time, I think I've taken probably more pride than I started with, as far as keeping the business kind of, you know, servicing, I guess you would say. You know, before, if there was a really great weather streak in 2013 or 14, and man, I would just close shop and, hey, let's go hunting for 2 weeks. Well, that really doesn't work, you know, if you want to grow a business. So, you know, and it's my livelihood. Obviously, it's my income. So you got to take care of the other end, maybe more so before the fun. So, yeah, that's an aspect that I probably would never hire out. I enjoy it, and I think that's the personal touch that goes into it.
Well, that pride is just like your better half, you know, inside the outdoors itself, is that, you know, you've started something that developed you into happiness, and you don't want to take that away from yourself, and you want to stick to the plan that you started with. And that's the pride that you have within it.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. Like, a lot of people will just hire that out and hire to the right person. But the pride that you have is immaculate, to say the least, you know, with Molt Gear itself.
And one thing I tell people, you know, as I get older, I, you know, snarl at the weather a little bit more, you know, a little bit. And one thing I tell people, it's always 68 and sunny in the shop. So
that's true.
Yeah. So not a lot to be disappointed out after a good day of work. So
how was your hunting season this year then?
Very, very tough.
Yeah. It was across the board for a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, there's, Rochester, you know, I don't want to brag it up by any means, because I would rather hunt in a spot that was, you know, unbelievable and you could, you know, get into them every day, but it's a very tough spot to hunt, you know, a lot of pressure, just really mean, nasty, grass-eating refuge geese that don't like to do anything. They stopped flying on sunny days. I remember it like almost it was yesterday, in November of 2001. So we're talking 21 years of not flying in the sun. Now they've stopped flying in the clouds. It has to be real dense, low-lying clouds. So you add on the weather of last year, which, you know, I'll be the first to say, we had geese. We had a really good number of geese here in town, but we just didn't have much for weather. And then the days that we did have weather, it was almost like they went somewhere else. You know, they didn't come back to the feed that they were in the day before. They didn't stay on the flight line, even with the same wind. It was just very unpredictable. They were very unpredictable. Even with good weather, and that just made for tough hunting. You know, it was, I think 2008, if I look back over the last 30 years, was definitely the worst year I've ever seen. But I think this one was probably second.
What do you think the change of the evolution of the goose? Like, what can you narrow it down? Do you think it's weather?
Well, they're
pressure?
Survivalist.
Okay.
They're survivalist. You know, when you look at a duck, ducks are, they're looking for habitat. You know, they're looking for that that transition of water to food, and hopefully it comes together in the same spot. You know, they're scoundrels for habitat. A goose is just looking to survive. And, you know, by the studies I've read and whatnot, you know, their average winter weight is dropping more now than it used to. Means they just don't move. They get in an urban setting, they get in a refuge, they get in town, and hey, why fly out of town and get shot at when I can just sit here and do nothing? Mm-hmm. And you know, they're just survivalists, and it takes really good weather for an extended period of time. You know, one day isn't nothing to them anymore. You know, when you basically, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, when you seen snow coming, you know, you licked your chops, you know, because this was going to be the day. Now these geese don't even really move in the snow, you know, unless you have weather stacked upon weather stacked upon weather day after day after day. And then it forces them to really get aggressive about feeding. Otherwise, you know, they're just consuming grass. They're losing a ton of weight. You know, even the birds we shoot now, you clean them, there's no fat on them. They kind of stink. They're really green looking. They're survivalist, and you know, there's no way around it. If a goose doesn't want to fly, you know, there's nothing you can do sitting outside a refuge in a field with all the decoys in the world and all the calling and perfect concealment if the bird doesn't get in the air and come out. And even if he does come out, he has to be in a mood where he's aggressive to feed. And those days with the changing weather that we've had over the last, I would say, probably 6 or 7 years, I've noticed, you know, just milder winters, you know, whatever you want to call it. I don't know if you want to call it global warming or whatever, you know, but you know, there's definitely a change,
right?
You know, we just don't have the winters that we used to have. You know, and this isn't my opinion, this is, you know, statistically, you know, facts, is that we just don't have the winter weather that we used to have, especially in November and December when you can hunt them, at least in Rochester, Minnesota. And these birds have really turned into just survivalists. You know, corn is not on their radar anymore. Soybeans, not on their radar, unless it really comes down to the dire end where they have to get out there and feed. So I think it's just a change of these birds are just learning to survive by not moving.
Now, has it always been Rochester that these statistics like come back on just Rochester, or is it Minnesota as a whole?
You know, I would say Minnesota as a whole is a very tough place to hunt. Produces a lot of good goose hunters, a lot of good callers, a lot of good field callers. You know, not a lot of guys in Minnesota get up on the contest stage, but man, oh man, is there a lot of good field callers in Minnesota. So, you know, and we also have more goose hunters than any other state. Yes, we harvest more geese than any other state. I think we have for, what is it, 30 years or whatever. So we put a lot of pressure on the birds. You know, when our season cranks off, let's say September 1st, I mean, guys, they don't let off of them. You know, they chase feeds. There's a lot of pressure on them. And I think over time, these birds have just you know, we see it very early here, and then it kind of spreads, mm-hmm. I guess you would say, as when it happens other places. No, but we go to, you know, we take trips, obviously. We go to Nebraska or Kansas or wherever, and it hasn't hit there so much. So it's almost refreshing. It's almost like you're going back 20 years in hunting geese when you go to those spots,
really,
so which is awesome.
You can take a lot of your knowledge from, you know, the hard stakes of Minnesota that you've noticed and take them to these other states. And I mean, waterfowl in general is not easy, but you can take it and disguise the plan a lot easier.
Oh, 100%.
Really?
100%. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, if you can, you know, if you're hunting geese in Minnesota and you're consistently harvesting geese, you can just, I don't want to say just crush them anywhere else, but you can do very well.
Right.
And that's not just my opinion. That's coming from a lot of guys that are here that take, you know, that go to other states and, you know, whatnot. Like you know, I was talking to Joe here last winter, Joe Heintz, and he went to Montana, and he's like, I don't even think you need ground blinds. You know, I don't even, you can just sit in the decoys Indian style, you know? So, yeah, I mean, there's a difference, you know, and a lot of it is based around pressure.
It is. And a lot of it also bases around, like you said, pressure and then weather, because weather isn't just stagnant in one state. You know, there's different weather pressure in every single state, because, you know, Minnesota might have, you guys have hundreds or what do they call it, thousands of lakes, you know, and then come to South Dakota or Nebraska or this and that and the other. Some of the lay of the land of how these geese like react is completely different, you know, so weather doesn't always push them off. It's like they absolutely do at the feeder, this and that and the other. It's every state has a different aspect, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And yeah, you know, pressure, whatever. I remember when we went out to Western Nebraska, 2017, I believe it was. And we went out there, and the time we went out there, we, you know, hit a cold snap, and it was negative, I think, 17 or 18 degrees, or it was going to be negative 17 or 18 degrees the next morning. Clear, crystal clear, sunny, negative 17 with snow. And we got out there, and we're talking to some of the guys, you know, the guys that we were hunting with out there, and, you know, just kind of brought up the point of, what time do we need to be the field? And they're like, well, they'll be flying by 8:30. Do what? They'll be flying by 8:30? Yeah. Negative 17, crystal clear. And they'll be flying by 8:30. You're dealing with a whole different goose. Our geese would fly at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. Sure enough, those geese were in the air at 8:30 and we were done by 9 o'clock, you know? So it's just, you know, different places, different kind of hunting. But yeah, I mean, that's one thing here where, just a lot of pressure.
And the way that you just described that story in Western Nebraska was like how my first experience in Western Nebraska went. I mean, we had flurries like right in the morning, but then it was just brutally cold and bright and sunny. And we had birds floating all over us like crazy. I mean, we had to work for them, but just like, even from South Dakota, I was like, wow, like why are they flying?
I mean, if you see the typical movement of a bird, take early season, opening day, you know, when are they going to fly? Right away in the morning. Oh, you know, yes. You go up to Canada, and gosh, I hope they take off that border deal for the unvaccinated.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love going to Canada and hunting, because you get to see waterfall, for most you know, across the board for the most part. And I know there's little pockets in Saskatchewan where their ducks get pounded a little bit and their geese, but for the most part across the board, you will see waterfall in their natural movement. Really? That means they're going to feed in the morning and they're going to feed in the afternoon. All geese want to do is, if they don't have pressure, is to go feed in the morning and go feed in the afternoon, you know. And it's like, I was talking to another guy that hunted Montana. He said their geese that they were hunting were flying three times a day.
No.
They're feeding three times a day. They'd fly out at 8 o'clock in the morning, go back in, come out at 11, go back in, come back out at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's what a goose wants to do. Well, when we start interfering with that process and we start, you know, hunting and shooting them, well, that just, you know, it condenses them down. It condenses that movement down. And, you know, you see it up in Canada. That's why people go there, because there's a ton of birds and they move. And that's the way it used to be. Yeah. But once these birds, you know, cross over that magical line of, you know, U.S. and Canada, and they get in a spot that maybe has a lot of pressure or whatnot, or maybe doesn't, it's either that activity stays the same, which it does, and, you know, some parts of the central flyway and west, but if they get into the Mississippi flyway, that movement really condenses down just because of the disturbance of hunting on them quite a bit, right. I think.
So yeah, I ask a lot of weird questions, Scott, so don't think of me differently when I do bring up this question. You know, you said geese in, you know, Minnesota are survivalists, you know. Why wouldn't they just, you know, dip around, you know, that flyway that they generate from? Because, you know, there's kind of like a follow to the leader when it comes to a very experienced goose, and the, you know, the molts and everything like that might pressure themselves to go somewhere else as well. But I mean, like, why don't they ever like change their direction of where they're going when they know that this is not a safe area for themselves and they have to change everything that they do?
Well, boy, that probably, I mean, you're talking about geese that nest in an area that they were born in,
right.
You know, female ducks and geese go back and they nest in the area that they were born in. And when that gets imprinted over, you know, hundreds of years, you know, the migration patterns, the towns they go to. And I think when it boils down to it, a goose doesn't know any different. You know, a goose in Rochester, Minnesota, that's, you know, losing 35% of his body weight over the winter, isn't talking to a goose in, you know, Bozeman, Montana, or okay, wherever. Yeah. You know, they don't right. know any better. You know, so they just know what works for them and what gets them back north in the spring to raise a brood and start the whole process over again. So, I think when that comes to the imprinting of the migration, you know, that's probably one that, you know, yeah, I don't think they communicate with the other ones.
No, absolutely. That's why I said I asked some yep. very strange questions, but they're open-minded, you know, but.
Oh yeah, you bet.
The evolution of like the goose itself. I mean, the more that I've goose hunted, and I mean, this is like this next coming season will be the 9th season, and I love every second of it. But mm-hmm. just hearing the stories from people that have been doing it for years, like yourself, what's your outtake for say 2025 or 2026 of like the evolution? Is it gonna get more harsh with pressure, weather, and the goose evolving and decoys calling and everything? Is that going to be a constant pressure of like, is there going to be a bar that just gets set and it's like, okay, we can't go any further? Or is it always going to be going up, you know?
You know, well, if you look at it over the last 20, 25, 30 years, you know, back how decoys looked back then, and then, you know, Art came out with the Bigfoot in 83 or 84, I think it was. You know, and then other companies came out with stuff, and look at the decoys we have now, you know, the calling, the concealment, you know, new companies come out with new concealment options every single year, you know, so what this is doing is making us more efficient killers,
okay.
to say the least, you know, so we've kept up with them decently, but when it comes down to where it's going to be in 4 years, 8 years, 15 years, you know, it's really, I think, in my opinion, looking at it from the, you know, from, I don't want to say my crystal ball or anything like that, but it's really going to come down to weather.
Yeah,
it's really going to come down to weather. You know, the cyclical cycles and the weather, you know, you look at, you know, people down in Arkansas are screaming, where are the mallards? Where are the mallards? They're shifting west. They're not getting here. It's the corn impoundments, you know, stuff. That was the same thing they were screaming in the 70s too, you know? So, you know, it's really weather-based. And what I mean by that is that goes twofold: spring weather, fall, winter weather.
Yep.
Spring weather to provide great hatches, you know, no matter what we do as far as hunting, matter what we do as far as calling, concealment, decoys, 75% of our harvest is made up of that year's hatch. You know, right. that's the bottom line, and it's been that way forever. So, you know, we're trying to keep up with fooling 6-7 month old geese. You know, as crazy as that sounds, but that's the bottom line. So it's really going to have to do with, you know, the last, like last year was a across the board, almost non-existent duck hatch. You know, there was very little production. So that's going to come down to the spring weather. You know, are we going to get those ponds? Are we going to get those wetlands back, the temporary seasonal ponds, the May ponds and stuff like that to produce a lot of ducks to keep up with, you know, harvest, or I guess you would say happiness of the hunter, you know, is mm-hmm. is that if there are more ducks being hatched, there are going to be more ducks being shot. You know, it's just the bottom line. And geese are, I would call them very what would be the proper term, they're very hardy nesters. They typically nest on a very a body of water that is there all year long. You know, whether it's a river system, a lake, a pond, you know, they don't deal with fluctuating water very often. You know, they're kind of the king of the nesters. They get back first. They stake their ground first of where they're going to nest, and typically that is on a permanent water source. So, and, you know, even with storms and, you know, whatnot, I remember in May of 2013, on May 2nd, 2013, we got 16 inches of snow in Minnesota.
Wow.
And the local newspaper showed geese at a nature center here in town. That female, that goose, was completely covered up with snow except from her cheek patch up. Mm-hmm. She was sitting on those eggs. 16 inches of snow buried her in there. The only thing that was sticking out of the snow was from her cheek patch up. And those eggs made it. And I think she had 5 or 6 successful goslings that spring. Wow. So they are very, very hardy. They're very tough.
Yeah.
But we still need good, you know, spring weather. So on the goose side of things, it comes down to more of that fall weather. I think it's just going to be this weather pattern of, I'm going to call it November and December in the upper United States. It has to change for us to, you know, keep up with the times, I guess you would say. Because I think the innovation of calling, the innovation of decoys, the innovation of blinds, the innovation of, you know, just communication from, you know, scouting with our Onyx to our phones, being able to communicate, how that all happens is all there. The one thing that needs to keep up is the weather. And we just need better winter weather, better fall weather, better winter weather, to force these birds into getting aggressive and feeding again. Because if it stays mild and it keeps getting milder, they're just going to keep doing less. And that's going to be the one that's going to hurt is, you know, cause if they don't fly, you can't hunt them,
right?
You know? And so I think the weather is going to have a lot of, factor on your question there is how's it going to look in 2025 or 2030. It's all going to be based on the weather.
And the cycles even get worse and worse every year, because a lot of people say like weather runs in a 5 to 10 year, you know, take your turn on that, whatever it may be, is that
sure.
The cycles on weather have never been able to be like distinguished, you know, and it's been worse and worse. Like I swear weather gets more mild and mild, because I'm only 24 years old and I've, you know, mm-hmm. growing up in South Dakota, we used to get this dump of snow like you were talking about in April all the time, like year after year, or just crazy
sure.
snow or crazy rain, crazy storms. And I have not seen that in the last 2 to 3 years even. And it's very like disguising of like what's going to happen in the next like 5 to 10 years of weather too.
Yeah. But, yeah. I think it was 2 years ago. Was it 2 years ago? 2020 or 2021. I never hunted in the snow one day in Rochester.
Wow.
That's just bizarre.
And see, this year for myself, I had, when I went to go to Kansas for something, I didn't see snow for several months until I drove into Missouri our entire winter.
Yeah,
and it was South Dakota. Right? It was just weird. Like I had to drive to mm-hmm. a different state to see snow in January yeah. and December. And that is so sad.
Yeah. Even last year, we've got a pile of sleeper shells that we love to use. And we usually put them out when we at least get, you know, half an inch of snow. Just set the story right. Never brought them out once last year because we never had snow. Yeah. Yeah. I might have hunted in snow flurries,
right.
a few, but I never hunted when there was snow on the ground.
You weren't trekking through snow to pick up dead geese. Let's put it that way.
That's correct. Yeah. And that is
it's a weird thing.
A sign of the times of the weather, man. It's something you can't control, which makes it the tough aspect to grasp or understand, you know. And I think, you know, a big part of that is, you know, those guys down in Arkansas, where are the mallards? They're
yeah.
moving west. They're moving this way. It's like, man, that permafrost line has moved up 100 and some miles over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, whatever it is. There's just no weather to drive those ducks down there. And it's the same thing with the geese. There's no weather to drive them out and to feed.
Have you,
you
guys,
know?
have you guys lost a lot of habitat with the no like great springs and everything of that nature for ducks or geese of that nature, like ponds and everything drying up? Is that a factor in Minnesota as well?
Yeah, here around Rochester, we don't have that habitat.
Okay.
You know, it's rolling hills, agriculture, timber, but it's rolling. You know, we're only 45 minutes from the Mississippi River. Okay. So that valley extends. Now, when you go 10, 15 miles west of here, she really flattens out. And they get into, you get into more of the habitat that you're talking about, but really the habitat you're really talking about probably doesn't start until, you know, western Minnesota, you know, the last 45 miles of Minnesota before it hits the Dakotas or something like that. So we, our habitat around here, you know, we'll have some nesting pairs of ducks, you know, a lot of wood ducks on the Zumbro River, some mallards on the river systems around here, but pretty much the bulk of our nesting is all done by Canada geese. You know, they nest everywhere around here. You know, they'll nest at the Fleet Farm parking lot, in the push cart stalls. They'll nest in people's shrubs. They'll nest. I mean, it's all Canada geese around here for the most part.
Right. And see, for South Dakota itself, I mean, I've been trying to, you know, venture out of just strictly goose hunting every once in a while, cause I love goose hunting over duck, but even the generosity of it is that I have not seen the ducks that we used to have through the flyway that I hunt over in like kind of like central South Dakota. And driving around nowadays, it's, oh, there used to be a pond there. Oh, there used to be a pond there. And I'm talking no more than 2 feet of water or something of that nature. And it's yeah. So hard to believe that that's the reason that, you know, these birds don't have a stopping point, you know, when during their flight. From Canada or North Dakota, whatever it may be, because we used to have a whole bunch of local birds, and now it seems like the local birds are very distinguished to a certain area because they only have that lake or they only have that pond. You know, before it was like they were a lot more spread out in our area.
Yeah, ducks, I mean, when I talk about creatures of habit in the fall, they're big-time creatures of habit in the spring, you know. So when that habitat gets tiled out and drained out, or, you know, like last year, it was kind of a dust bowl for most of the prairie pothole region, you know, those ducks are going to find somewhere else. They're not going to nest. They're going to go north. They're going to do something else, you know. So it's duck habitat is definitely changing more than the goose habitat for sure.
What's one of the greatest reasons that you love waterfowl in general? Let's just leave aside the business, leave aside everything else in your life, just Scott itself. What do you love about waterfowl the most?
Calling.
Really?
100%. Yeah. I'll never forget the first time I really recognized geese or associated with them. I was feeding the calves, which was in a barn, or I should say a shed, about 50 yards from our main barn where we milked all the cows. And I got done feeding the calves, and I was walking back with the pails, and 9 Canada geese flew over my head at probably 30, 40 yards high. And it was just, you know, I heard the whistle first. And I looked up, and they went right over my head, and they set out, and they went back over the heifer shed. And they started to drop into our back field back there. And you just heard that. And they just disappeared like into the sunset. You know, it was like one of those magical things. And I was like, wow, that was cool. You know, I knew what a Canada goose was, but I never really been around them. You know, I think I was 10 years old at that time. And I never, you know, kind of put it together, or, you know, I even knew there was goose calls or anything like that. So that was in, I think, probably October or early November when I was 10, and I asked for a goose call for that Christmas. And I got my first goose call, and man, that kind of what started the love for the sport. Now, I love Canada geese in general. I love ducks in general, you know, just the overall, you know, the mating for life, the migration, the whole aspect about hunting them and, you know, how they do things. I love all that part of it. But if you ask me the question you did, it's definitely calling for sure. You know, just the communication aspect of the whole thing. And That's one thing probably why I like turkey hunting a little bit, because of the calling. And that's probably one reason why I don't really, go snow goose hunting, is because, you know, it's all on mic, you know, it's all electrical collars, you know, and stuff like that. So,
and how much stuff you have, you know?
Yeah. That's besides the point. That's another added on to it. But yeah, I would say it's definitely the calling, the communication, the sounds, the, that's what I love. Ducks and geese. You bet.
That's awesome. Cause I mean, the basis for me when I started off with this stuff is like when I went with Nick Schneider for the first time ever, he ran molt, and like seeing him sit there and conversate with the birds, like, cause you can hear the back and forth here and there. And sure. Him committing them birds, like, you know, 5 yards from our feet, that will never, ever leave my brain. Never, ever once. And it's great to hear from yourself that, you know, you were 10 years old and you can still tell the exact story, you know, the shed that they flew over and this or that and the other. That's like the stag or the status of why you started, you know, that's the reason why you want to do it. And it's crazy to ask that question, because it can generate a memory that maybe you haven't told in probably maybe years or this and that and the other. Maybe you tell it every day, who knows, but it's great to hear why somebody absolutely started it. It can be millions of things of why they still do it, but there's a reason why somebody started waterfowl.
Yeah. And I think that's why, I enjoy what I do. I enjoy tuning every call. I enjoy, you know, designing calls, because it's all based around that sound. And whenever I go hunting, you know, I just love the sound. Now I love all aspects of, you know, setting the spread and scouting and visualizing the hunt and all that stuff, and timing and migration is fascinating, and just, you know, the birds in general, but just love calling the most, for sure.
How many calls you got to tune after this?
Well, it's Sunday. We get asked that a bunch. I never have any idea. I just know every day I come out here, I just have to make as many calls as we can make in one day, and it's the same thing the next.
Well, Scott, it was a pleasure having you on. Thank you, everything that you do for, you know, the community itself, and, you know, teaching a lot of people about calling and teaching people about, you know, the aspect of the goose itself, and holding your status of it is amazing. And it's great hearing the stories that you have, and just keep on moving forward, my man. It was a pleasure having you on.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on, and do it anytime.
Absolutely. We'll do this more often. Don't you worry about that. Okay.
All right. Sounds good, bud. You take care.
Take care, Scott.
Bye.